The next case on our calendar is 08-1334, National Union Fire Insurance Company versus Richard O. Worth. Justice Stratton has recused herself in this case. We're pleased to have sitting in place of Justice Stratton, Judge Mary DeGennaro, who is a judge of the Court of Appeals from the 7th Appellate District. Welcome, DeGennaro. Mr. Callow.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. May it please this court, Joe Callow, along with Charles Miller and Danielle Diodessa, the law firm of Keating, Meeting, and Kleekamp, representing National Union. Your Honor, we're here on a certified question from the Sixth Circuit on an issue of Ohio law that affects the fundamental practice of lawyers within the state and will have a profound impact on how law firms and clients interact in legal profession in the years to come. In this particular matter, we are on appeal because the Federal District Court made a ruling of Ohio law, without citing any Ohio law, that an attorney-client relationship cannot be formed between a law firm and a client. It cites no statute, no common law, no rule for this fundamental premise, and yet, based upon this erroneous premise, makes three separate rulings which created the appeal that led to the certification here today. The first of which is that because there's no attorney-client relationship, there is no direct claim from an aggrieved client to a law firm for violations of duties owed under common law rules and statutes by that firm to the client. The second was that because there is no attorney-client relationship, there is no direct claim for respondeat superior liability, for the law firm being liable for the acts of its agents and servants within the practice of law. And the third of which is that the statute of limitations against Mr. Richard Worth individually had run because the court solely focused on an attorney-client relationship with one particular attorney within the law firm and didn't focus on the attorney-client relationship between the law firm as a whole. Under 2305.11, it didn't look at the latter of the two events and misconstrued when that statute would run.
Well, counsel, let me walk you through some. We have a narrow, straightforward question to answer. Only the question has a hook on it. It looks simple at first, and the Comer case, I dissented in that, so I should be four square in your camp without reservation, because that was a independent contractor, and this is a partner.
Correct.
In the firm.
Absolutely, Your Honor. If I could reserve 2 minutes for rebuttal, yeah. I failed to do that, Your Honor. I'd like to do so. Comer is trying to put a square peg in a round hole in this case, Your Honor.
But this would only be Comer if you had filed against the law firm and the one attorney. That's what I understand. See, the problem is we almost need to know a lot more facts than we have in front of us in order to answer this question, I think.
Well, I think it comes down to an issue because there's confusion as to what the Sixth Circuit actually certified. The question from the Sixth Circuit is, can you bring a direct claim against the law firm without naming any of the partners and associates? Because the district court said, unless you name the partners and associates, unless you name the agents and adjudicate the claims against the agents, you can't bring the claim against the law firm.
But you named one.
We did.
And didn't name any more.
We did not, because the law firm and the relationship with the law firm encapsulated all those other relationships.
And to answer the question, don't we have to know what was the contract? What was the relationship? Did your client, not your client, did the client who employed I guess that's what, AGI or a subsidiary of AGI?
National Union employed the law firm of Lane Alton, Your Honor.
Did they develop this relationship because of their relationship with an individual lawyer, or did they have a contract with the law firm? We don't know any of that, and you can't even find that in Judge Smith's decision.
Judge Smith did not go into it. It is in the Sixth Circuit record, Your Honor, both the letter of understanding.
We don't have that, do we?
We can make the Sixth Circuit record available to the court and all the facts that went into that brief, Your Honor. In the record is the letter of understanding between National Union and Lane Alton. Also in the record is the termination letter of the relationship between Lane Alton, where in May of 2002 they terminated our relationship in this particular matter.
Well, let me deal with Comer first. It seems to me this would only be Comer if you had filed your action, your cause of action, in January, let's say, and then when the trial was in what, March?
February, Your Honor.
February. March 21st blew by. Mm-hmm. Then they said, you're done, because the statute is run on the offending attorney, or the one that you named.
Right. The problem with the
That would be Comer.
Right. And the problem with Comer is that because of the unique history of hospital liability and how we start with immunity and go from exceptions to it, this court's ruled that you must name an independent contractor physician in the estoppel area in order to bring that type of claim.
Okay. Now, the underlying all of this is a suggestion that legal malpractice, firms don't practice law, individual lawyers and associates practice law, and that to maintain a cause of action, you have to name the individuals that you believe committed malpractice. That's one argument that's advanced.
That's certainly what the district court seemed to be indicating, is that despite the fact that we contract with clients and law firms, that we get billing statements between law firms and clients, that we pay law firms rather than individual attorneys, you have to sue individual attorneys, which means you're inviting managing partners, litigation heads, boards of directors, associates, all the attorneys to be named individually, creating havoc within the litigation community. The relationship with the law firm is supposed to stop all that from happening.
Okay, let me get to, I think, what's the final factual problem that I see in dealing with this. Because on one level, I think I agree with it. You ought to be able to sue law firms. The statute starts running when you know or should have known. And Judge Smith saying the day this man couldn't be in court any longer, you knew for sure. Your argument would be, well, but we had a continuing relationship with the law firm, and while the statute doesn't say that, there are court cases that say the statute doesn't start to run until the law, you know, there's no longer an attorney-client relationship.
Correct.
Okay, now here's the factual problem for me. Can you seriously say that we have an attorney-client relationship when you tell the law firm, notify your insurer, we're going to sue you for $8 million or $8.5 million. And that's a factual dispute that the federal courts have. Isn't that the end of the relationship? They're there still working because they have a duty to mitigate, rather than that they're there because they have an attorney-client relationship. It seems to me if you tell me you're going to sue my law firm for $8.5 million, We don't have an attorney-client relationship at that point. We have something else.
Well, fundamentally, that discussion was there were issues with the cognizable event before the jury verdict on February 21st, and there were discussions afterwards. But that attorney-client relationship continued until May precisely because the case law indicates that law firms should have an obligation to mitigate the results associated with it. During that pendency of time, that attorney-client relationship continues until it is formally terminated. Well, and that relationship is with the law firm and with other members of the law firm with that opportunity and a duty to try to mitigate the issues associated with it.
I have a hard time thinking of that as an attorney-client relationship at that point. It seems to me it's it's partners in mitigation at that point between the insurance company and the law firm rather than an attorney-client relationship.
To the extent that National Union believed that there was an attorney-client relationship because its attorneys were still trying to work to resolve the problems associated with Mr. Wirth and were still offering advice to National Union up until the termination letter.
Well, but
that
but,
factual issue must be resolved in favor of National Union at that time.
Sometime before the end of the trial, you brought in a Cleveland attorney who's an expert in defense. You brought in Percy Squire, who's apparently a friend of the judge, is what I gather from what Judge Smith says as to why he's in the case.
And those mitigating factors don't change the underlying attorney-client relationship with Lane Alton until that relationship is terminated. Because if it goes from a factual determination that Lane Alton thought they were still representing us, and we thought they were representing us, so until the termination letter in May, there must still be an attorney-client relationship. At worst, Your Honor, that's a question of fact right. That would get to be resolved. But the
so
court
counsel,
didn't
counsel,
even get to that issue.
Counsel, a fractured relationship, which is not unusual in a relationship between a large firm and a large corporation or even individual clients and their attorneys. And until somebody literally pulls the plug on the relationship, it can limp along in some form or another. And that's what you're asking us to take a look at as opposed to who did what when. And it's just the overall concept in addition to getting back to the real question here is, can you have a relationship with a law firm and even when you're not, the law firm in general, as opposed to a relationship solely with an individual attorney? And I guess one of the reasons that I would, one of the things to think about at least is, when you contract with a law firm, are you contracting for one specific attorney, or is it kind of a team approach that you go to a law firm because there's more than one player, so to speak?
Absolutely, Your Honor. You go for the collective willpower and strength of a team of attorneys, whether it be a litigation firm or a corporate firm. And people, clients like National Union, contract for that collective strength. So to somehow suggest that now, when you have those contracts and relationships, you can't bring a claim if those relationships are violated or breached, just throws the attorney-client relationship on its head.
When there's an agreement entered into between the client and the law firm, was Mr. Wirth the individual that bound the law firm to be the law firm for this client?
He was assigned principal responsibility for this case.
Well, he was assigned it, but was there a document in writing that established the parameters of the relationship,
the letter
contract?
Of understanding establishes the billing relationship and how that would
and
go forward
signed
in this particular
that?
Case. It's on Lane Alton. The letterhead, I believe, Mr. Wirth signed on behalf of Lane Alton.
Okay.
Yes. Is that in
Mr.
evidence?
Callow?
Is that document in evidence?
It's in the Sixth Circuit records there with the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. It's not in the appendix because the factual record was not brought over with this certified question of law.
Mr.
And in this instance, then, your only cause of action and the only question before us is whether, under Ohio law, a legal malpractice claim can be maintained against the firm. That doesn't relate to a breach of contract claim, such as a breach of that engagement letter, because this is limited to a legal malpractice claim. Am I correct about what the question is here, broader than that?
The legal malpractice claim includes both claims in tort and contract. It subsumes all the different claims that could be brought between a client and a law firm based upon prior precedent of
the
court.
I think a claim for legal malpractice is dramatically different than a claim for breach of contract, is it not?
I think the precedent of this court says that a legal malpractice claim subsumes both contract and tort claims within it. Whether the claim is for fees or staffing or for a violation of the rules of law, all of those are subsumed within a legal malpractice claim. And I think the certified question is whether or not that claim can be brought directly against the law firm without having to name all the individual attorneys that are associated with it.
Your time is running, and we hadn't really gotten to the certified issue very well. The issue can be answered without the record. That's the reason the record isn't here. We don't decide the factual issues when a federal court certifies an issue to us. It's a straight legal question, isn't it not? I mean, I think the legal question is that if
Ohio is going to allow clients to contract with law firms, and law firms are going to owe duties to those clients, de facto, there must be a direct claim that can be brought by an aggrieved client against that law firm.
Mr. Callow, I've been trying to ask, with respect to the certified question, does the form that the law firm practices in make any difference? In other words, if it's an LLC, if it's a partnership, to the issues that are before us with respect to the certified question.
Whether an LLC, LLP, or a PLL, those forms are designed among the partners or attorneys to decide how they're going to allocate liability among themselves. It doesn't change the fact that the client should have a claim against the LLP, LLC, PLL, and they can divide the liability accordingly. But this fundamental issue is whether or not you need to name all the individual attorneys and the risk that you may run if you don't name all the individual attorneys. We never even got an adjudication on the facts. We never even got a factual determination of whether any individual attorney or associate committed liability. The district court ruled as a matter of law there's no attorney-client relationship and ignored all the facts in the record on that
counsel,
point.
That's where I keep coming back to the problem I have with the question. It is my reading of Judge Smith's opinion is that although you couched some of it as a direct action against the law firm, he said in reality it's all a derivative respondeat superior, even the parts that you couch that way, that in reality you sued Worth.
Right.
And that's all you did.
Right.
And so subsumed in this question are facts that are beyond our knowledge, or it seems to me that that's the problem we have.
The error, Your Honor, and I refer you to page 23 of Judge Smith's opinion, the error is not just in saying that we didn't sue them, because what he said is, unless you name them as individual parties in the case, unless they are adjudicated liable as parties, you can't bring the claim against the law firm. That's like saying in a corporate liability, we'd have to sue the employees who are binding corporations or partners who are binding partnerships.
I thought he said you don't assert claims for failure to properly supervise or those kinds of things, that in reality, all of your claims in your petition are derivative of one man's failure to act or to act properly.
Judge Smith recognized our direct claims and said on page 23, Mr. Marsh, Ms. Hudson, and Ms. LeShuck cannot be liable because they have never been sued. It had nothing to do with the factual allegations or whether we brought expert testimony or anything to the effect. His ruling is because they were not sued as individual parties.
And our question, legal question, is that an accurate statement of law?
Exactly,
regardless
Your Honor.
Of who the parties are, regardless of what the evidence shows with respect to who in the firm managed or should have been managing Mr. Worth or was there at the courtroom and saw how he acted, and that's not, we don't really need to determine that, do we?
And I apologize that I'm going over my time, so let me be brief in the response.
Answer a question.
I think that's exactly right, Your Honor, because the fundamental error was in saying that there is no attorney-client relationship between a law firm and the client. Once that correction is made, the Sixth Circuit will then be in a position to correct what we believe were the errors of the district court.
Or we may agree with the district court's statement of law.
Or you may agree, and then we would have... Respectfully, I think we'd have a lot of problems within our state, Your Honor. I think you would see a pandemonium with respect to malpractice litigation, an explosion of individual defendants and conflicts among those defendants. And respectfully, that's why law firms assemble, to be able to attract better clients, use their collective skills, And when that doesn't happen, the client should have a right to go against the law firm without naming all the individual people associated with it.
You have used your time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Callow. Mr. Walker.
Good morning, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Lawrence Walker, and with Benjamin Parsons, I represent the respondents Richard Worth and Lane Alton and Horst. Let me first emphasize, before addressing the Sixth Circuit's question, that this was a legal malpractice case and nothing else. This court, over the last 20 years, has defined what legal malpractice is on no less than three occasions, most recently, just last year, in Environmental Network versus Goodman Weiss Miller. A malpractice case is when a lawyer, in the course of practicing law, commits a mistake that damages or injures his or her client. It is as pure and simple as that, and that is what they sued Richard Worth and Lane Alton for. Primarily, that Mr. Worth made a mistake or a series of mistakes in the nationwide case that was pending.
Counsel, do they say that he's the only one that made the mistake?
He's the primary one. Their allegation as it related to other attorneys in the firm, specifically Mr. Marsh, who took over after Mr. Worth's representation terminated, and those assisting him, was that the firm was directly liable for what they did or did not do, as opposed to being vicariously liable. Right. The claim as it related to Mr. Worth was that the firm was vicariously liable for his malpractice. The district court held that Mr. Worth himself was not liable due to the expiration of the statute of limitations. It then went on to state that the firm could not be vicariously liable for Mr. Worth's alleged malpractice because he himself was not liable.
But isn't the argument that if you put Mr. Worth to the side, that the question is, can the firm be directly liable and not vicariously liable in this situation because of their relationship with the client?
Your Honor, first of all, let me say that there was no evidence of a contract. The district court, in its opinion and its recitation of the undisputed facts, specifically stated that Mr. Worth was retained. I'm referring to 540 Federal Supplement 2nd at page 902. The undisputed fact, according to the district court, was, and I quote, Plaintiff National provided liability insurance coverage to McLaren's and Larry Wood for the claims asserted against them. Richard O. Worth of the Lane Alton Law Firm was retained to represent them. The letter of understanding they keep talking about, and which you do not have before you, is a letter dated in December of 2001, about 2.5 years after Mr. Worth was retained, and about 2 months before the nationwide trial began, stating what the hourly rates are for Lane Alton lawyers on cases that would come to Mr. Worth starting the next year. It didn't even apply to the nationwide case. But yes, they did raise and argue with the Sixth Circuit this notion of direct liability.
And the court found that there was, that there's no potential, there's no possibility to have a client, an attorney-client relationship with a firm if there's no named associate or partner that is also liable.
What the district court held, Justice O'Connor, was that there is no such thing as a direct claim, which means a primary claim, against a law firm for legal malpractice.
Which translates to there cannot be an attorney-client relationship between a law firm as an entity and a client, and that's the question before us.
The question before the court, I respectfully submit, is whether or not a legal malpractice claim can be maintained against a law firm if the lawyer who committed that malpractice has been dismissed or is not a party to the suit. And I respectfully submit that the answer to that question is that the claim against the law firm cannot be maintained if it could not have been maintained against the lawyer had he or she not been dismissed or joined.
Another way of looking at that same question then, and I think at least for my purposes, and I could be wrong, is that you have to determine whether you can have a attorney-client relationship between the client and the law firm that would allow for direct liability as opposed to vicarious liability.
Your Honor, that's...
Even if the lawyers were still in, even if the statute had not run against Mr. Wirth, would there still be a cause of action against Lane Altman separate from the cause of action against Mr. Wirth?
If the statute of limitations against Mr. Wirth had not run, and if Mr. Wirth, in fact, committed malpractice, then yes, the firm would be vicariously liable for that malpractice.
I think we all agree on that. I think what we need to focus on is, can the firm be directly responsible?
Your Honor, the firm cannot be directly liable for the malpractice committed by one of its attorneys for the following reason. It is well-settled law that one party, one individual, cannot be liable for a wrong committed by another. This is Hornbook tort law. This court in Albane versus Flower Hospital.
I thought one of the arguments of the petitioners was that the law firm, the appropriate persons in the law firm, didn't supervise, didn't essentially blow the whistle on Mr. Wirth and pull him out of the case or provide him with the kind of assistance he needed. Which would be direct? I took that would be direct liability from on the law firm because it independently of Mr. Wirth's malpractice, that the law firm had somebody in the law firm had some obligation to correct the situation for the benefit of the client.
That would be a claim, Mr. Chief Justice, for negligent supervision, negligent monitoring, what have you. That is not a legal malpractice claim.
Why not? Because if you say the law firm has an obligation to the client and persons in the law firm other than Mr. Wirth don't engage in the kind of supervision, whatever you want to call it, which then affects the well-being of the client, that's not malpractice, I guess.
No, Your Honor, it's not. As this court has defined it in Strzok versus Presnell, Vahila versus Hall, and last year in Environmental Network versus Goodman Weiss Miller, malpractice is a claim that one or more lawyers has performed beneath the standard expected of lawyers to the damage of a client.
Well, if there is
a claim against a law firm for not staffing a case or not monitoring a case or what have you, that's not legal malpractice. That is some other claim.
If the lawyer's supervision falls below the standard that's acceptable, why is that not malpractice? It's negligence, but why is it not malpractice? If the firm is at, take your test that we've developed, why is it not malpractice for others in the firm to not intercede or whatever you want to say for the benefit? So the client receives the representation that the client would expect or meets the standard.
I think Your Honor is referring to a situation where the lawyer in charge of a matter assigns a junior lawyer to do this or that and then does not monitor or supervise that lawyer. That
would be an example.
That would be an example.
So,
but the duty rests with the practicing attorneys for malpractice purposes.
Lane Altman did not have a duty to the client?
The primary duty, Your Honor, was to the lawyers in charge of the case. with primary...
I said Lane Altman. Are you saying that Lane Altman had a duty to their employees, Mr. Wirth and the attorneys in the case?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying the duty resided primarily in the first instance with the lawyers in charge of the case. In this case, Mr. Wirth, and then after his representation terminated, Mr. Marsh.
There was no cause of action filed against Mr. Marsh, however. He was never named.
That's correct, Your Honor. Only Mr. Wirth was.
Would it be your position then that if there was a management committee or a supervising attorney who had negligently supervised or failed to provide funding necessary to undertake the litigation on behalf of Mr. Wirth, that those individuals should have been named as defendants for committing legal malpractice, and not Lane Altman?
Your Honor, our contention is that the firm would be vicariously liable for any malpractice committed by a member of the firm, regardless of whether that member was named or not named. The issue is whether or not, had the member been named as a defendant, would he or she have been liable?
So what we're saying, to follow up on the Chief Justice's line of inquiry, if Mr. Wirth had negligently performed, he could be named a defendant, and the firm would be vicariously liable.
Correct.
And if an individual in the firm had negligently supervised him in that capacity, that individual could be named, and the firm would be vicariously liable if there was a liability judgment there.
Provided that Mr. Wirth could be or was a judge liable for malpractice, since this court has held for a negligent supervision claim to be maintained, the person who was supposed to have been supervised must be liable to the plaintiff for whatever the damage or injury is.
Mr. Walker, are there any other states that have dealt with this question and that have held that one may bring a direct action against a law firm for malpractice?
Justice Lanzinger, we have been unable to find, and the petitioner certainly has not cited, any case from this court, any other court in Ohio, or any other court in the land where it was held that a law firm is or could be directly liable or primarily liable for the legal malpractice committed by one of its attorneys. We are aware of no learned treatise or a provision in the Restatement of Law Governing Lawyers which provides for such a thing. Indeed, the context of the Sixth Circuit's question to this court is the vicarious liability of law firms established or set forth under Section 58 of the Restatement of Law Governing Lawyers.
Is that in part because a client deals with an individual lawyer in the attorney-client relationship? I mean, we're trying to look at the parameters of that relationship. If malpractice occurs, who would be the one responsible? The attorney with the direct relationship with the client, or the law firm that the client is going to?
The person primarily responsible and primarily liable is the attorney. The firm is secondarily liable.
And you're saying the law firm could never be directly
for legal malpractice. Now, a law firm could be liable for breach of a contract to provide able counsel, or for breach of an engagement letter or something of the sort. But that was not this case. This whole issue, if it pleased the court, about the contract with the law firm never came up until the appeal to the Sixth Circuit. That was never the claim in this
counsel,
case.
Counsel, coming back to the notion of negligent supervision, and again, we don't know what was pled about Rick Marsh after he took over the case. It sounds like the evidence of harm all relates to prior to the collapse of Mr. Wirth. And that would relate to his performance and also the failure of other lawyers in the firm when he asked for help to provide it and those kinds of things. With respect to the firm, that sounds like negligent supervision, and we can quarrel about whether that's a malpractice claim or something else, some other tort. It seems to me that in this context, maybe perhaps it is malpractice. My question is, if we were to determine that the law firm could be sued directly for those things for which it's directly responsible, where does that leave? Essentially, I think they're trying to drag back in Mr. Wirth's underperformance, if there was some, and keep it alive, because they feel the statute has not run against the law firm. Would that necessarily be the case if the only thing that the firm is responsible for is negligent supervision? And let's call that malpractice at this point.
Your Honor, if we're talking about negligent supervision, the firm could not be liable for that negligence in this case because Mr. Wirth is not liable for malpractice. And that was the holding of this court in Strzok versus Presnell and has been cited by the
So Sixth. That would under, because the statute ran on Wirth, that undermines, even if we called it a malpractice claim, that would undermine the claim against the firm for negligent supervision.
Exactly. Exactly.
Mr. Walker, I know the red light's on. I hate to ask questions after the red light's on.
Please do
this
so, sir.
This is my first opportunity to ask a question.
Doesn't stop anybody else.
I've noticed that, too. I'd like to back up just a little bit and get back maybe to some of the basics here. If this were not a law firm, but it was a partnership, and I guess we're a little uncertain as to what form Lane Alton is practicing, or a limited liability company, and one of its partners in the non-legal partnership engage in negligent conduct, and the partnership could be sued directly, right, without naming the individual partner?
Yes, but its liability would be vicarious.
But you could prove that without actually having the individual in or not?
Yes.
Okay.
And that,
all right,
if it pleased the court, was the holding of this court, the essential holding of this court in Comer versus Risco. In that case, the individual physicians who committed the alleged medical malpractice were not joined as defendants. And this court held that the hospital could not be vicariously liable for their malpractice, not because they were not joined, but because the statute of limitations against them had expired by the time the complaint was filed against the hospital.
No, that's not correct. The statute had not run when the complaint was filed. It ran, and they had not named the doctors.
Your Honor, if it pleases the court, there are some facts in Comer which are not expressly set forth in this court's decision, but are in the decision of the Fifth District and the record before this court. The statute had not run against the hospital, but it had run against the two physicians. We have a one-year statute of limitations, which in medical malpractice can be extended an additional 180 days if the plaintiff sends a letter to the defendant saying, I'm planning or I might sue you. In that case, the plaintiff sent a 180-day letter to the hospital, but did not send one to the two physicians.
All right. My question is out of the malpractice arena. My question is a plain old garden variety partnership. Can a partnership be sued directly and be liable even though the partner who committed the negligence is not included in the lawsuit, not been named in the lawsuit, whether or not the statute of limitations is run? I mean, garden variety partnership or limited liability company?
Yes, but the liability is vicarious. And by vicarious liability, I mean to say, for the partnership to be liable, the negligent partner must be capable of being adjudged liable had he or she been sued. So that if the statute of limitations had expired as to the individual partner, the general partnership could not be vicariously liable for that partner's negligence. Likewise, if the individual partner had entered into a release, a settlement, had been discharged in bankruptcy, the general partnership could not be vicariously liable for the partner's negligence.
Mr. Walker,
so your assertion then is that it makes no difference that this is a partnership, if that's what it is, of lawyers, because it's the same rule that would apply to a general garden variety partnership.
Yes, Your Honor. As it is, Lane, Alton, and Horst was and is a limited liability company. The rules of vicarious liability, particularly in the area of legal malpractice, are the same regardless of whether the firm is a general partnership, limited liability company, or some other artificial legal entity.
Thank you.
Mr. Walker, turning to the analysis in Comer, it seems to me the parties have a different perspective on what issue the analysis turns in that case. So my question to you is, does the analysis turn on general agency principles that the agent is primarily liable and the principal is secondarily liable? Or did that case analysis turn on the fact that the parties who were precluded from being held liable by the statute of limitations were independent contractors as opposed to liable employees? Of the employer in that case, because as counsel points out, three appellate districts since Comer have said that analysis turned on the independent contract status. You've got vicarious liability. Does it matter if it's respondeat superior or agency, or is it a difference without a distinction?
It is an important difference, Your Honor, and if I may explain. In Comer, this court noted that the allegedly negligent physicians were independent contractors. But then the court stated that for the purposes of its decision, they became agents by the operation of estoppel. And as soon as that transformation from independent contractor to agent occurred, the court held that the case became governed by general principles of agency law, not those applicable to independent contractors. And it then went on to reaffirm three fundamental principles of agency law, which have long been embedded in Ohio jurisprudence and which we submit answer the Sixth Circuit's question. Number one, that the principal is indeed liable for torts committed by its agent, a rule of law which is dramatically different from that applicable to independent contractors, since the principal, generally speaking, is not liable for torts committed by its independent contractors. Principle law number two is that the nature of that liability is vicarious. That is an important point, since the general rule is that one cannot be liable for the wrongdoing of another. The only exception is vicarious liability, also known as secondary or derivative liability. And the third principle of law is that for the principal to be liable for the torts committed by its agent, the agent must be liable or capable of being found liable. in the three appellate decisions, Judge DeGennaro, that you mentioned, and we're talking about Walmart stores, Bob Evans Farms, and Marymount Hospital, the courts of appeals went to extremes to try to distinguish those cases from Comer. And the primary distinction they pointed out was Comer dealt with physicians, and these other cases dealt with store clerks, restaurant waiters, and nurses. The true distinction between those three appellate cases and Comer was that the agents in the three appellate cases, if they were proven to be negligent, would have been liable had they been sued. Whereas in Comer, that was not the case. In conclusion, we respectfully request that the court answer the Sixth Circuit's question as follows. The claim against a law firm for legal malpractice cannot be maintained if it could not have been maintained against the lawyer if he or she had been sued. Unless there are any further questions, I'll be seated.
Thank you, Mr. Thank Walker. You. Mr. Callow, you've used your time, but take a minute, start with a minute. We took Mr.
I will be brief, Walker. And I appreciate all the questions from all the justices on this. I know this is an important issue. And the one I'll focus on is Justice Cupp, because I think he nailed it on the head. Corporations act through employees. Partnerships act through partners. Principals have agents and masters have servants. Nothing in the law requires you to name the agent, the servant, the employee, or the partner individually to establish a claim against the master. And it's the Latin phrase that this court has adopted, qui facit per alium, facit per se. The actions of an agent are the actions of the principal. They're one and the same. And an aggrieved party can sue both or either, and the inability to sue one does not affect the ability to sue the other.
Counsel, however, as I read Comer, it seems to me that the court was talking in broad agency principles. I mean, they cited cases where the fact pattern included respondeat superior specifically in a case where the negligent conduct at issue was allegedly engaged in by independent contractors. I mean, looking at the certified question, doesn't that almost presuppose vicarious liability? Because otherwise, why not just certify the question, under Ohio law, can a legal malpractice claim be maintained directly against the law firm and stop there? I mean, the way it's been phrased seems like it presupposes it is vicarious liability.
We would have been happy if that was the question, nay or nay, and left at that, because I think that is the fundamental issue we're wrestling with. The problem with Comer is, though, it deals with the independent contractor, as you said in your question to Mr. Walker. It's premised solely upon an estoppel claim and doesn't go to the respondeat superior nature of law firms, corporations, partnerships. And I think that's why a number of appellate courts have limited Comer solely to an area of the unique area of a hospital liability with independent contractors. In the Bob Evans case, in the other cases that we cite in our reply memorandum, they've narrowed the focus of Comer because respondeat superior generally, as applicable to all other scenarios, is that you do not need to sue the agent or the servant in order to have the direct claim. And when Mr. Walker keeps saying that you have to have an adjudication against the individual, we were never given that opportunity to adjudicate the claims. We were stricken in the federal district court as a matter of Ohio law without a citation or reference to Ohio law. So the factual nature of either Mr. Worst's liability or any of the other individuals at Lane Alton was never adjudicated. And I think that's why you see this constant effort to reframe the question. The issue, I believe, is as simple as saying, is there a direct claim against the law firm, whether you name anybody else, whether they're identified in the complaint? It should be a yes or no question. I believe that this certified question must be answered affirmatively.
Counsel, I want to take you back to Justice Cupp's question. And as I've been thinking about this and how lawyers do lawsuits, they tend to name a lot of people. And for example, when something goes wrong in a hospital and they don't know who all was in the operating room and the clock's running, they may make some John Doe and Jane Doe kinds of things. I think maybe that's out of an abundance of caution rather than a legal necessity. So let me take Justice Cupp's question and turn it into something that's maybe easier for us to understand outside the law firm situation. A truck driver causes a horrible accident, and it's his fault. And he's employed by a partnership, and the truck driver is an itinerant and is gone, and you can't find him. And you never get him served. You still have a live lawsuit if you sue the partnership?
Absolutely. And the partnership is liable, and the partnership has 6 years to go find that itinerant truck driver and bring whatever claims that the partnership wants to do against it. But the fact that I, as the aggrieved party, can't find your employee, and I'm now at a loss because I can't name or serve them, the partnership can't say, hey, wait a second. You have to name the truck driver. You can't find and serve him. I'm off the hook. That's the whole reason for respondeat superior. And I think the reason in medical malpractice cases why you find the naming of all those parties is the confusion of Comer, of whether they're an independent contractor.
Well, they were doing it before Comer, I think.
But in the legal malpractice case, respectfully, one of the reasons why a client goes to a law firm is because I have a firm. I have an entity. And all the responsibility is for that entity. If Mr. Wirth declared bankruptcy, if Mr. Wirth left the practice of law, if Mr. Wirth unfortunately died 2 months afterwards, I, as the client, am not responsible for chasing down Mr. Wirth. I'm going after the law firm, and the law firm does that. I'm not going to name the supervising attorneys or the managing partners. I'm not going to conduct discovery to figure out who the people are that should have reassigned the case. That's why I retain a law firm. That's what the law firm's responsibility is for. That's why my direct claim is with them. And if given the opportunity to prove that there was negligent supervision, to prove that the managing partner should have done something different, to prove that the friends who knew that he was having these personal problems and the alcoholism and did nothing during this case, that's what the evidence should show. We never got to the point because of this fundamental issue of law misstated by the district court. And that's what needs to be corrected. The direct claim exists against the law firm, who is responsible for the actions of its attorneys. And if the affirmative question is answered in that manner, we will then get the opportunity to go back and do the adjudications and determine the factual issues and identify what the letter of understanding says. But I respectfully submit this is a straightforward yes or no answer. And given the question, I hope that all of you answer yes in the affirmative on the certified
question. Thank you, Mr. Callow. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. Marshal, please adjourn court.